This fucking guy.
Hello again, my little cheese nips. Welcome to This Fucking Guy, a podcast about self-care, if self-care is one long scream into the void.
Here is where we use expletives and alcohol to emotionally process the creeps, jerks, and p-words that compose the shitty elevator music of our lives.
I'm just a poor boy from a poor family. Ren Martinez.
And I am just a poor boy, though my story seldom told, Ginger Golub.
Am I stupid if I don't get the second one?
It's The Boxer by Simon and Garfunkel. I know that
I love The Boxer. I just don't know any lyrics.
I want to try to call you out for that, but I think that I'm just like a lyric nerd, so I can't. No, I can't rightly give you shit about that.
Like, I love some Simon and Garfunkel. Like, I get down on some, like, very sweet male harmonies. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? Like, the you know? But when I hear The Boxer, like, the title, I immediately think of Carbon Leaf, which is, she is the boxer. She knows when and where to strike.
I have no idea what you're talking about, but I will look it up.
I love Carbon Leaf.
It sounds like a bop.
Carbon Leaf is, of course, like a Richmond band, like born and raised, live in the fan. And it's like, if they had, I think they had two radio hits. I think they had Miss Hollywood, but the big one was Gray Sky Eyes.
If you say so.
But they're like an Irish, Celtic-influenced rock pop band?
I mean, that sounds like me all over. I'll look into it.
I'm surprised you don't know who they are, honestly.
I'm surprised I don't know who they are. I'm sure if I, like, went back to the archives of when I had iTunes, that it would be like, oh, yeah!
Honestly, because out of the two of us, usually I'm like, hey, look at this pink-dipped sprinkle music that I'm listening to. It's shiny and full of noise. And you're like, ah, listen to this very sad lesbian strumming a guitar.
Yes. And I'm right and you're wrong, and that's fine.
There was a series on TikTok that this girl was doing. She had a beautiful voice, by the way, but it was like classic rock hits are just lesbian indie hits. And she was singing Born to Run by Bruce Springsteen, but like with that singing in cursive thing and just like the little strokes on the guitar. And I'm like, yeah, that's a lesbian indie pop anthem.
To be fair, all Bruce Springsteen is lesbian indie pop just waiting to happen. I don't know why, but it just really is.
It just is. I mean, it's for the girls and the gays. That's it. Yeah.
I'm on Fire is only okay if it's a woman singing to another woman. Otherwise, straight to jail.
Straight to jail. Speaking of jail, is there anything you need to scream into the void?
Yeah, so speaking of jail, and dear listeners, I was just saying to Ren, oh no, I didn't prepare anything to scream into the void. Should I look at the news and then realize, no, there's just too much going on in my life. And in terms of things that I can scream about into the void that are not going to get me uninvited from dinners, I think I'm going to go with the fact that there is somebody at our office who keeps shitting under the building.
Oh, yeah, that's...
Yeah, we have a very particular office where most of the parking is located, like, literally underneath the building.
Like, parking deck style.
Yeah, like, minimum once a week, there is the largest, definitely human turd you've ever seen. Just kind of on the sidewalk, just there. And I don't know what to do about it. We've been making the, frankly, unfair assumption that it's an unhoused person, because like sometimes those folks are sort of like around the area, but frankly could be a coworker, could be a disgruntled coworker,
could be, knowing some of the people we work with. It's a fun email to write where it's like, what am I going to contact our admin assistant about today? Is it going to be the fact that once again it's Roachella and we got a huge lineup of giant roaches, you know, like it's, you know, Beyonce's here. Roach version of Beyonce is here. It's a big deal. Mm-hmm.
Susie Cream Cheese has just turned off the podcast, yeah, sorry, by the
cupcakes,
way.
They're cupcakes. Cupcakes. Really big cupcakes. Or is it, hey, admin assistant, there's more human feces in our parking lot. Could we call the landlord about it?
Things are fine. Things are fine.
Hey, it's just some of the perks of, like, downtown. You know, when people talk about living in cities and working in cities, right? They're talking about the fact that you can walk to your favorite coffee shop when you come out of your building. Like, the beautiful architectural, mm-hmm. like, view of having all these buildings from all these different, like, decades. Sort of, you know, again, like, all the amenities that you can get walking outside on the sidewalk. Being able to walk around. And then there's also human feces. And there is just...
Mm-hmm. If you get enough people in one place, at least one of them's going to have to poop.
You know, honestly, if we just kind of like Rochella, I think we just need to like reframe the human feces things. Honestly, it's just Burning Man. Okay.
Start planting seedlings.
Well, it's Burning Man in the parking lot. Hey, guys, Burning Man's happening in the parking lot again. Like, you know, it just is what it is. Make sure you clean up after yourself. Who's got LSD, right? Like, it's reframe it into a musical cultural event and it doesn't seem so bad.
Oh, God. Anyway.
Oh, man.
With that, I feel
downtown,
like...
Downtown, we work downtown. Anyway.
Downtown, where there's human shit on the sidewalk.
It's on Skid Row.
I was not in tune, but part of that's that I cannot hear myself very well. Anyway, I can hear you great. It's fine.
Well,
but yeah, clearly I need therapy.
Don't we all? All right, Gingy, let's get to it. So.
Yeah, I know you've been psyched out of your mind about this, and for once in a recent while, I have no goddamn idea what you're doing.
Well, what I realized recently was we haven't done enough cults on this podcast.
That's true.
That's true. So lots of people, okay, have covered your Jonestowns and your Mansons and your Scientologies. So I decided to go for something a little bit more niche. A little less obviously murdery.
Okay.
It's like, you know when you go into your silverware drawer and you see your spoons and your butter knives and your forks, and they're generally fine, but then there's that one fork that's like left over from college or something. It has like thinner tines and the material is like tinnier and it's flimsier in your hand and it works just fine, but you hate it for you hate that fork. You never want to use that fork, but you can't just throw away a perfectly fine fork. Imagine that fork was a cult. Have you ever heard of the Oneida Silverware Company?
What a wild introduction. They do silverware? Why do I think that they did baked goods or something?
They are a flatware company. Oneida is one of the world's largest designers and sellers of stainless steel and silver-plated cutlery, and is the largest supplier of dinnerware to the food service industry in North America.
Wait, I thought they were Amish.
They are not Amish.
Oh.
So, you've heard of Oneida.
Yes-ish.
Again, they do forks. That's the thing. Their forks and spoons populate many a kitchen drawer across this fine nation. You may have some in your drawer right now.
I definitely don't. I have the best from IKEA.
Well, what you may not know is that this giant conglomerate's modest origins begin in the late 19th century in Oneida, New York, specifically with the Oneida community led by one John Noyes.
Okay.
So John Humphrey Noyes, I know how much you love a middle name.
I love a middle name.
He was born on September 3rd, 1811 in Vermont. His dad was the very important John Noyes Sr. He was a minister, a businessman, and a member of the U.S. House of Representatives.
Okay.
His mom, Polly, was aunt to Rutherford B. Hayes, 19th president of the United States and owner of one of the better presidential beards.
And somebody who I will get to eventually.
I quickly looked him up because I couldn't remember. He kind of was the end of Reconstruction.
Oh, girl, we'll get into it another day.
That's his shit.
Not enough time.
But yes, so John Humphrey has quite political connections. He was apparently a very thoughtful boy who loved his mom. Mm-hmm. He once wrote her a letter proclaiming his homesickness for her and his family.
Was he not at home?
He was at, like, boarding school.
Oh, okay. If he was, like, in the living room, that was going to be a lot.
I mean, Mom, I miss you so much. Honestly, with like, a 16-month-old, I mean, I am getting letters from her constantly being like, Mother, I miss you. I am in the trenches of war. Meaning, I currently don't have my Cheerios
in my cup. Kraken is riding home from Valley Forge.
Ugh, my dear lovely Kraken. Who was outside in the rain today, had a great time, returning to her watery roots. Anyway, so the redhead, because he was a redhead, also boasted a fiery nature, as one of his friends from school said John was, quote, inclined to give way a little too much to the libido corporis.
So he was horny.
What lust of the body are we talking about here? What horniness are we speaking of?
I mean, I would assume the penis horniness.
It is a penis horniness. His diaries indicate by the time he entered Dartmouth College in 1826, he was quite horny. But as a teenager, he struggled with shyness and the belief that he was utterly repulsive because he was a ginger.
Oh, big H.G. Wells energy. Not H.G. Wells, H.P. Lovecraft.
Yes, he thought he was hideous.
Didn't mean to malign H.G. Wells there.
In one diary entry, he recalled that he was at a party and he did not use the right name for the lady he was introducing to his gentleman friends. He could, quote, feel his cheek burn with shame upon recollecting the scornful smile that passed over the countenance of a certain lady who had overheard the blunder.
I mean, relatable.
I know, right? I would just die immediately.
Yeah.
This is why I don't use names.
I mean, I like him so far. He's horny. He's ginger. He's socially awkward.
He's you.
He's me.
But John would eventually overcome his social anxiety and have quite the way with the ladies. All of the ladies. Anyway. Foreshadow. John graduated from Dartmouth College in 1830, was clearly slated to go to law school and follow his father's political dreams. But Dad, that's your dream, not my dream. Or at least that's what I assume he told his dad, because he revealed that he had found religion and was going to become a preacher.
Okay.
This religious fervor was brought about after John met evangelist Charles Grandison Finney, another middle name I thought you'd appreciate.
Grandison.
Finney was the leader of the Second Great Awakening and has been called the father of old revivalism.
Is the Second Great Awakening one of those doomsdays going to come? We can predict exactly when it's going to happen.
Not really. So essentially, this was a Protestant religious revival. Kind of just re-embracing emotionality in the supernatural and rejecting the skepticism of, kind of the lingering Enlightenment stuff.
I mean, in that era, I'm not sure that narrows it down.
Well, again, like, 1700s is all about, like, Enlightenment, science, rationalism, deism. And so this was kind of like, hey, let's go back to, like, God shit. Right? Admittedly, for an old school evangelical preacher, Finney did not suck as much as he could have.
Okay.
His religious beliefs led him to be a supporter of social reforms. Specifically, he was an ardent abolitionist and believed in the equal education of women and African Americans.
Love that
for him.
Mm.
John Noyes, now having abandoned his father's law dreams, decided to enroll in seminary to become a minister. This eventually led him to enrolling in Yale Theological Seminary to get his doctorate in Bible stuff.
Fancy.
His days were spent reading the Bible, talking about the Bible, practicing preaching the Bible. But he did have enough time to start some light political activism on the side by helping to organize one of the first anti-slavery societies in the United States.
Again, you haven't said anything that I am not in favor of yet.
Fair enough. this is more of a weird and wacky story rather
Oh, okay. So this is the episode where at the end of it I go join a cult in upstate New York.
Maybe.
Okay.
Yeah, this is more of the weird and wacky rather than the actual, like, bastardry that we usually deal with.
My blood pressure thanks you.
Yeah. You're welcome. During this time, Noyes began refining his specific religious belief. So a lot of the background I got from this was from a book called Religious Experience of John Humphrey Noyes by George Wallingford Noyes. And this was some Noyes, like, descendant.
Rana, I'm going to stop you there. You read a book for this podcast?
I did read a book. I read a lot of books. This one's really cool. First of all, it's like part of a library online, so I can just read it online.
Oh.
But so this is a compilation of basically a bunch of original documents. So like letters that he wrote, things that he printed out, other teachings, things like that, all kind of smashed together into this book. So according to this book, he was talking to his dad and started to express some alternative views. Quote, "Take care," said his father. "That is heresy. If you get out of the traces, the ministers will whip you in." "Never," said Noyes. "Never will I be compelled by ministers or anyone else to accept any doctrine that does not commend itself to my mind and conscience."
All right.
So first, Noyes came to the conclusion that the second coming of Christ had already occurred.
Interesting.
Back in 70 AD.
Huh.
So this...
Why?
He said he looked at a bunch of, like, religious doctrine because he was, like, looking up, like, part of his Bible study stuff was, like, what does it mean to be, like, resurrected in the second coming? And what would that look like? And he essentially was like, oh, it must have already happened. So this already meant that mankind was now living in a new age. Mm-hmm. So because of this, we're no longer living in the age of prophecy and, like, promise, but instead living in the age of fulfillment and resurrection. But what was that fulfillment? So Noyes basically argued that the culmination of Christ was the entire salvation of sin. So the whole point of a second coming is that you are free from sin entirely. He began arguing that unless we were truly free of sin, then Christianity was a lie. So, like, because Jesus had come back, if we weren't free from sin, then Christianity had to be fake. Furthermore, only those that were entirely free of sin were true Christians.
I mean, God, this is a man who lived so long before C-SPAN.
it's giving a lot of 700 Club energy, but mm-hmm. less bigoted.
Yeah.
But of course, how does this make sense, right, with the everything that people are? So back to the Religious Experience book. "Hence to him, the kernel of holiness was perfect love of God and man. This new conception, while it added to the scope of holiness, simplified greatly the problem of its attainment. The 1,000 precepts of law were reduced to one, that is love. And love, which is the essence of holiness, was made easier by the wonderful example of it in the life of death of Christ himself, which is called Christian perfectionism."
I mean, it sounds like a post-it note that says, "Don't be a dick."
It's kind of that. So essentially, this is part of the Second Awakening, is there's this movement called Christian perfectionism. And that's what this concept mm-hmm. is, which essentially is that the union of, like, people with God is characterized by the pure love of God and others. And because we love God and he loves us, like, that's essentially that's the only thing you have to do. The only true law you have to follow is loving God and loving others. And so because Noyes was like, that's the only thing you need to do, fulfilling that precept meant you could be sin-free. So on February 20th, 1834, Noyes declared himself free of sin and in a state of perfection.
I mean...
sin-free.
Mood.
Just declaring yourself sin-free.
Uh-huh.
Also low in fat.
I mean, isn't that frankly what, like, Trump is doing at all of his depositions? Just like, I declare myself sin-free. Didn't do it.
That, it is true. I think you have to actually pretend to like people or do good things. You can't just like be stabbing a baby and say, ha ha, I'm a good person. I think it requires a little bit more.
Because as somebody who's not a Christian, like, I like the idea of this. This sort of appeals to me, but also it's sort of, it's like, then where is accountability?
We'll get to accountability.
Okay, okay. Continue.
Our God is an awesome God. He reigns from heaven up. Anyway. So not surprisingly, just like his dad warned, such ideas were in direct opposition with the popular Calvinist orthodoxy, which, if you remember, like, seventh grade social studies correctly, humans are inherently evil and probably witches. Go pray and die.
Oh, you also went to school in Southwest Virginia?
That's Calvinism. It's everything sucks because you suck, go pray, and then die. These fucking buzzkills denied John his license to preach, and he was forced to leave Yale.
Cool.
He ended up back in Putney, Vermont, and took his much peppier preaching show on the road. Quote, I took away their license to sin, and they go on sinning. They have taken away my license to preach, but I shall go on preaching.
All right.
So he starts doing his thing. He's telling the word of perfectionism. He's talking about God shit. And people start listening. Honestly, I don't blame them when the other, when everything else is just, humans are a sinful sin bunch full of sin.
Oh, yeah. Way more actually Christ-like than the Calvinists around him.
Yeah. So he had a bunch of different converts. One of them is going to prove particularly important, which was a wealthy woman named Harriet Holton. She came into the picture when her friend Miss Clark, who was already a convert, introduced her and was a, quote, a young woman of high standing in church and society. Less conspicuous than Miss Clark and less gifted in the arts of expression, she had greater depth and truer instincts. So enthralled by John's preaching, apparently Harriet sent him $80 as a love token.
Ooh.
Which, I don't know what $80 is in, like, 1860 money.
I'm Googling it.
But it's a lot.
Hold on. $3,163.
No man's worth that much. But yeah, so she sent him that as, like, I love you. So they were married in 1838, in what started as a traditional Christian marriage.
That is the most ominous you've said anything.
Remain so. So Harriet gave birth 5 times in 6 years. 4 of them were premature. Ooh. And only one survived.
Oh.
Yeah. So obviously this was very traumatic for both of them. And yeah. Noyes began to study the structure of traditional marriage and sexual intercourse within that marriage.
Mm-hmm.
This is where some of the horniness is going to start coming back in, okay?
Yeah.
So some of these thoughts he had already dictated in what's known as the Battle Axe Letter.
In what's known as his own fan fiction.
Which is, honestly, this is all God fan fiction, to be honest mm-hmm. with you.
What are religious texts but God fan fiction?
Noyes sent this letter in 1837, prior to meeting Harriet. This was after a failed love affair where the woman ended up marrying someone else.
Okay.
Not only does he proclaim to be the one true leader of the perfectionists, which is a thing cult leaders do,
mm-hmm.
he also proclaims that there will be no marriage in heaven.
Mm-hmm.
Here's another kind of long quote. I'm sure I will cut some of this in post. Quote, when the will of God is done on earth as it is in heaven, there will be no marriage. Exclusiveness, jealousy, quarreling have no place at the marriage supper of the Lamb. I call a certain woman my wife. She is yours, she is Christ's, and in him she is the bride of all saints. She is now in the hands of a stranger, and according to my promise to her, I rejoice. My claim upon her cuts directly across the marriage covenant of this world, and God knows the end.
Okay, so he's into probably not ethical polyamory.
Well, actually, not necessarily non-ethical, but definitely poly. He's definitely leaning into poly.
Well, how does his wife feel about this? Or is he
Well,
okay,
he starts
we'll get to it.
He starts putting this poly plan in action in 1846.
Cool.
When he started getting hearts and pants feelings for the wife of one of his early converts.
Cool.
Instead of, like, you know, doing the normal thing of just either having an affair or dealing with it silently, he persuaded this couple and his wife to merge their unions in what he called a complex marriage, in which both men were married to both women, such that they could all have sex with each other.
They're just swingers.
They're swingers! They're religious swingers.
They're religious swingers, which, oh boy.
Religious old-timey swingers.
I don't hate it.
This is what the cult is, by the way, as we continue. This is like the core of it. So the two couples moved into a house.
Silverware Polycule. The musical.
I love it. Silverware Polycule. So the two couples moved into a house together in the same year. In mid-1847, again, this is before the Civil War, and they're up living in their poly household, fucking each other brains out. So in mid-1847, Noyes and some of his male converts began extending the scope of complex marriage to include more than just one couple, but pretty much all converts. So anyone who was hanging out with him at the time.
Everybody fucking.
So all this fuckery led to John's October 1847 arrest for adulterous fornication.
Yeah. Like, I don't, it shouldn't be a crime. But, like, yeah, bro, it's 1847.
So he was arrested, but he was, like, essentially put out on bail. The trial was set in April. And he was like, no, deuces. And rather than deal with all of it, he fled Vermont to New York, taking his 87 followers with him.
His 87 mistresses.
His 87 mistresses, fully graduating to cult status with the birth of the Oneida community.
Goddess bless. Do we know if the dudes and ladies were fucking each other or if it was all just heterosexual swinging?
I think it was primarily heterosexual. I think that's pretty clear in all of the writings. I couldn't guarantee it, but that seems to be the case.
Mm.
So Noyes already knew some friendly perfectionists with land, and they built their first communal dwelling in 1848. Followed by the very famous, they have a mansion house. Mansion house. So the community grew to 172 people by 1850, 208 people by 1852, and was at its peak in 1878 with 306 members.
That's frankly too many people to be married to.
That's a lot of people to be married to. One's plenty.
Yeah.
There are actually other branches of, I think it's pronounced, so it's his last name, I think it's Noyesian communities in Connecticut, New Jersey, and in Vermont. So okay. He was popular.
Yeah.
And lots of people were like, hey, we're into this fucking thing.
New England had suffered under the tyranny of no fucking for so long.
So long. And honestly, still does. Does anyone fuck in New England?
I mean, my sister-in-law's got 5 kids.
Begrudgingly. No, I'm kidding. I was meaning the sex was begrudging, not the kids, but both are bad. Anywho, let's talk about the principles of the Oneida community. So Noyes stressed the importance of community over individual. This is part of what he called Bible communism.
Okay.
Basically.
That's a mood.
It is a mood. Actually, if you look up Christian communism on Wikipedia, their symbol is the sickle, but instead of a hammer, it's a cross.
Oh, God, that's a Reddit thread I kind of want to get on.
Oh, yeah?
I don't know what this brand of person looks like. I feel like it's so rare for me not to have seen this exact brand of person on TikTok.
I don't know, man. But basically, the idea is it's a theological view that compels Christians to support, like, religious communism. Mm-hmm. The idea that, like, Jesus clearly lived in a commune with his apostles. It was all about, like, giving to the community and supporting each other. And, like, we should do the fucking same.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So All the Oneida community members were expected to work according to their abilities. Those skilled jobs tended to remain with one person. For example, like their financial manager was the same person the whole time. Community members rotated through the more unskilled jobs. So each would take turns with field work or in the house or in other growing industries because the Oneida community had a bunch of different businesses that they were part of. They were manufacturing leather travel bags, weaving hats, constructing garden furniture. They did some tourism. And of course, they got into silverware manufacturing. Mm-hmm. According to Wikipedia, Oneida embodied one of the most radical institutional efforts to change women's roles and improve female status in the 19th century America. Women were allowed freedom in the commune that they simply were not afforded outside of it. They were able to wear functional bloomer-style clothes, they were allowed to have short hair, and participate in all types of community work.
I'm back in.
You're back in. You're like, honestly?
I'm back in the cult.
Man, that took no time.
I'm very easy. I've told you about the fact that DJ and I watched the Vow, the Nexium documentary, mm-hmm. and the entire first two episodes, he's like, honestly, I'm in. I'm joining. It wasn't until the third one that he's like, I think this guy might be bad. I think this guy might be bad, Gingy. And I'm like, yeah, honey. I don't think that they were going to do a documentary about a good cult.
I think I haven't seen it yet, but I have been interested in seeing the Mother God documentary.
Because
because it's a cult, but all the bad shit she did to herself. So I guess that's not too bad, you know?
I mean, I was going to say same as Jesus, but I think other people definitely did that to him.
I'm pretty sure she died of silver poisoning.
Oh,
because she
I have
she,
no idea about this documentary.
She did a lot of colloidal silver.
Don't recommend it. But speaking of cults who are into silver.
Yeah. So in Oneida, domestic duties were still kind of primarily done by the women, but they were also free to like get into business or be artisans and craftspeople. Mm-hmm. They took active roles in the commune, shaping policy and participating in sort of the daily running of the community.
Into it.
And this practice of complex marriage meant that women and men had equal freedom in romantic and sexual expression. Oneida acknowledged and accepted female sexuality, and it was an actual community expectation that women were to have orgasms during sex.
I'm packing a bag.
Let's go to New York, baby.
Let's go to New York.
So Ellen Wayland Smith, who was the author of The Status and Self-Perception of Women in the Oneida Community, said that men and women had roughly equal status and that while both sexes were ultimately subject to Noyes's vision and will, women did not suffer the additional oppression that were guaranteed to deal with in outside society.
Mm-hmm.
They only had one dude telling them what to do.
Yeah.
Versus society. So part of Noyes's idea of community before individual also results in the practice of mutual criticism. This is less cute. This is a less cute thing. This sounds like my worst fucking nightmare, by the way.
Oh, no.
In order to eliminate undesirable character traits and keep everyone on the road to perfection, every member of the community was subject to criticism by a committee or the community as a whole during general meetings.
Oh, it's just Instagram.
So this is actually this practice of mutual criticism is actually something you see in a lot of
art schools.
What I was going to say, those wilderness camps where they send kids to get abused. Because essentially what you do is you sit in the center of a circle and everyone around the circle tells you all your faults so you can fix them.
I feel like that would feel like about 4 hours.
I can barely handle a supervision with my supervisor when it's me and one-on-one.
Oh, yeah, and she does not press anybody.
No. But yeah, so that's mutual criticism. Not my favorite part of this cult.
Like, I think that it's coming from an okay place, but I think that we've seen enough of, like, how it's deployed that, like,
I do think that in what I've read about the Oneida community is that this practice is probably the least abusive I've ever seen it having like read up about some of these wilderness camps and like other like cult like entities, it's usually a very abusive tactic.
I would imagine.
So then, of course, we want to talk about the juicy stuff. We want to talk about the complex marriages. The whole swinging reason that they had to flee in the first place. So complex marriage was the idea that everyone in the community was spiritually married to everyone else.
Rad.
Noyes is actually credited with the term free love.
Ah.
That's him. That's his cult. That's the silverware guy. Free love. So exclusivity and possessiveness was frowned upon, and it was expected that everyone had to have sex with everybody.
Had to?
So, not necessarily you had to have sex with every single person in the cult, but it was like you could not have a favorite. You had to, like, scout around. You had to have a variety. Apparently everyone kind of did. Noyes did argue that traditional marriage of one man and one woman was contrary to biblical teachings, which I guess is not unfair.
There's all sorts
of shit in the Bible. And such traditional practices only spurred the vices of jealousy and selfishness. So exclusive relationships were not permitted, and any couples that seemed to be growing too close were separated.
Mm-hmm.
Noyes was very involved in making sure everyone was boinking everybody else.
Oh, no.
The pairing of a man and woman for sexual intercourse in the community had to be approved by committee.
Oh.
And Noyes would use his judgment to determine what partnerships were formed when. Mm. He would also encourage relationships between community members and those outside of the community, hoping that the many orgasms would influence the attitudes of outsiders.
It certainly is better than whatever the Jehovah's Witnesses are doing.
Not even a birthday. But of course, this wouldn't be a cult if it didn't have its creepy elements. Okay.
I thought that fucking by committee was probably part of that.
It's already
all
right. Weird, right?
It's already weird.
A little weird. According to Wikipedia, Noyes believed sex-limited traditional Christian marriage practices left most young people facing sexual starvation from puberty, which according to Noyes was 14, to the age of marriage, which was about 24.
Mm.
His solution? Noyes had women over 40 act as sexual mentors to the adolescent boys.
I've unpacked my bags.
Just slowly pulling out your cardigans, setting your shoes back on the floor.
I mean, what an awful thing to put 14-year-old boys to. What an even worse thing to put 40-year-old women through.
So his reasoning was that they would have a minimal chance of conceiving, so it was safer.
Oh, boy.
Likewise, only Noyes and a few other older men had the skills and self-control necessary to participate in sexual intercourse with the younger women.
There it is.
Although there most it is. Of the virgin females of the community were reserved for Noyes himself.
Yeah.
And it's a cult.
And, so, I was rooting for you. We were all rooting for you.
I didn't come here to be friends. I came here to be America's next top virgin fucker. I don't know.
I didn't come here to make friends. I came here to make 87 spiritual husbands.
That's too many husbands.
Too many.
As all the members of the community lived in the same communal home, it made keeping track of who was fucking who very easy. So again, you're all living in the same house. So it's not like you like creep down and like fuck somebody. You have to again like go in front of committee and be like, guys, I need to get that dick. Is it cool? Is it cool if I get that dick? And they're like, we find this dick to be religious. Yes, you may have this dick. However, after finishing, you were not allowed to cuddle. You had to go back to your rooms.
Why?
Because again, you're not allowed to form partnerships.
But you're married to all of them.
You cannot hold one person above other, so you're not allowed any post-coital cuddling.
There's no cuddling in heaven.
No cuddling. Not even a cigarette.
They don't seem like they would be cool on smoking, to be fair.
Probably not, honestly. But hey, this wasn't just a giant fuck fest for no reason. Noy has developed a distinction between amative love and propagative love. So essentially, there's a difference between sex for the purpose of expressing love and that for having children. Which actually helped him kind of reason sort of the religious stuff as to why it's okay to, like, fuck 80 people.
Okay.
So I'm sure you're thinking, with all that fucking, gotta be a ton of fucking kids.
I would imagine so, yes.
But no. Noyes was very adamant of sparing women from the pain and anguish of childbirth as much as possible. Again, this idea with his wife Harriet suffering all of those pregnancies mm-hmm. and all that stuff. He was like, women shouldn't have to do this if they don't want to. So the Oneida community enacted a system of what's called male continence or coitus reservatus. Basically, it's the form of sexual intercourse in which men do not ejaculate within your partner, avoiding the seminal emission that leads
it's
to
pesky It's just the pull-out
things.
Method. It's just the pull-out
It's not pull-out. It's not pull-out. The idea is that you do not ejaculate. This is like sting, tantric, karmic, like zen sex.
Huh.
Like you can achieve, or it is possible for people with penises to achieve orgasm without seminal emissions. And that's essentially what they were practicing. Unless you wanted to, like, have a baby. So,
I feel like my face looks like that lady that's doing the math equations, GIF.
Butterflies in the sky, I can go twice as high. That's always what I think of. So, in his 1872 essay, Male Continence, Noyes argued that the method simply, quote, proposes the subordination of the flesh to the spirit, teaching men to seek principally the elevated spiritual pleasures of sexual connection. It allowed the sexes to communicate and express affection for one another.
Mm-hmm.
So while popular theories of abstinence required resolve, Noyes believed that male continence required the same power of moral restraint. Additionally, the technique put more emphasis on the woman's pleasure than the man's. Noyes reported, quote, my wife's experience was very satisfactory. It has not been before. So basically, when these dudes aren't focused on coming as quickly as possible, women enjoy the process.
Yeah. I'm still trying to figure out how you do, how.
Let me, okay. You, so let me tell you how good they were at this pull-out method. Sting. No cum method. This no cum method. Of around 200 adults using this as birth control between 1848 and 1868, so the period of 12 years, only 12 unplanned births happened. That's how good these men were controlling their dicks.
Yeah, I feel like that's worse than the hit rate of the rhythm method in my own family.
Man, it's better than, like, what Catholics do. They're just like, oh, shit. Here's number 7. Fuck it. It is a rhythm of the night. La, la. So, yeah, they've only 12 unplanned births in 20 years. That's remarkable.
Yeah.
The Oneida community believed in only having children with purpose and preparation. And they fully believed.
Okay, I'm back in.
You're back in. You're like, that guy's a little bit of a creep, but honestly, women's rights. They fully believed in a woman's right to choose when and if to bear children. The commune believed it wasn't just about parents being prepared for children, but that the whole community needed to be prepared to support that new generation.
Mm-hmm.
It was during this time that Noyes began forming a new idea after reading the likes of Plato, Francis Galton, and specifically Charles Darwin's Principles of Breeding.
Oh, okay.
What was this new brain baby?
Oh, no.
What else but the first positive eugenics experiment in American history?
I'm back out.
So, he coined his idea, stirpiculture, because stirps is like Latin for like root or something. And of course, for him, it was designed to create more spiritually and physically perfect children. He did this before eugenics was the term. And actually, like, the creation of the term eugenics explicitly tried to separate itself from the thing Noyes had already created.
Because they were like, whatever he's doing is weird. Because
it's like weird religious shit that they don't like.
All right.
So the experiment began in earnest in 1869. Men and women interested in having children would come before a committee to be approved and matched based on their spiritual and moral qualities, not their physical appearance.
Okay.
Admittedly, older men in the community were especially sought after, according to the community's idea of ascending fellowship, as Noyes believed that they were much wiser and more spiritually sound. Women were typically between the ages of 20 and 42. So not so much in the way of child brides in terms of baby making. Yay?
I mean, 20 feels that way, but yeah. For the 18-whatevers.
Each potential parent was required to sign a contract committing themselves to the experiment, and most importantly to God and Noyes, who they considered his human representative. Because it is a cult.
Yeah.
Most important in these pledges were the promises to avoid any, quote, personal feelings in regard to childbearing.
What?
So, let's talk about how children and childrearing happen in the Oneida community.
Okay.
Once a child was born, they stayed with the mom for about 15 months until they were weaned. During this period, the mother was allowed and even encouraged to breastfeed, and this attachment was encouraged not because it was between the child and mother, but because it was between child and caretaker.
Mm-hmm.
But once the children were weaned, they were moved into the children's wing. During this initial transition, children still slept with their mothers at night until they reached a certain age, and then they were discouraged from sleeping in their mother's rooms. Still concerned with creating a bond between child and community, the child would often sleep in the bed of a community member. This member changed periodically, so no special attachments were formed, and thus detract from the overall communal commitment. If it was suspected that parent and child were developing too close a bond, there would be a period of separation. So, children were not raised by their biological parents, but under the supervision of the community. Mothers and fathers were assigned the job of childcare.
As someone who hasn't had a babysitter in about 8 weeks, this sounds better than it should.
Yeah, so again, this idea of like community surpasses individual. And like, remember how we were talking about like all of those jobs were rotated? Like people could work different jobs. Being a mother and father, like mothers and fathers were like part of the job rotation. So like you worked in the children's wing for a while, helping to take care of children.
Okay.
So the children were surrounded with guidance and support from multiple sources. Parents were allowed to interact with their children, but like the children's like committee was the final authority in regard to their rearing.
I'm imagining the children's committee also being made up of a bunch of children in robes.
We have come to make this mud pie in honor of our ancestors. Bring the dead bug. that's what I assume happens. Children are really into cults. Like,
yeah.
I think I would have joined a cult at 6.
Oh, yeah. Because they're just incredibly comfortable with authority.
Well, it's also like, children don't realize what spooky shit. You know?
I don't know that that's true, but I think children also love spooky shit.
Yes.
Or maybe we were just spooky little kids.
We were, but I think kids are also kind of inherently spooky.
Yeah.
Just, they're so much closer to the veil. I don't know. So, admittedly, these children, brought up in a healthy country environment with plenty of fresh air, good food, and attention, were often safe from the chronic diseases that struck children in more crowded locations. Mm-hmm. They were all given routines that included work, school, playtime, and prayers, all adjusted according to age. So 58 children were produced as a result of this experiment. Most men and women only produced one child, though, to prove his religious and social prowess, John H. Noyes and his son Theodore produced 12 children between them.
That sounds right.
Records indicate that the children of Oneida were well supported and cared for. They were given a lot of playtime, and both girls and boys were provided an education, and some of the kids even went to college, were encouraged to do so.
All right.
So, like,
it's not the worst.
It is not the cults to be raised in.
Of all the cults to be raised in, it's probably up there, but you're still raised in a cult.
Yeah, it's definitely like, I mean, I think bottom of the list is like a Jonestown.
Yeah.
And then you got like your weird LDS ones that are like out in Utah that like you're married off at 11. And then this one is like, oh, I get to have a bunch of different moms and dads and they all are weird about fucking. But like I get to play a lot and I get to go to college.
Yeah.
I'm not a child bride. But this experiment did end in 1879 with the dissolution of the Oneida community.
Oh.
So there were a lot of reasons this was happening. First, John was trying to pass leadership on to his son, Theodore, who sucked as a leader and also wasn't religious. So not the best cult leader.
No, that wasn't going to work well.
Within the commune, there continued to be much heated debate about when children should be initiated into sex and by whom.
Glad they're talking about it.
So, like, again, they didn't, when they first started and they were having all this stuff about, like, oh, yeah, younger members should be initiated by, you know, older members, they didn't have that many. They didn't really have children for, like, 20 years, right? Mm-hmm. They only had, like, the 12 accidents. So then they start having a bunch of kids, and people are like, I don't know how I feel about this kid fucking an old lady. Like, I don't know.
Yeah.
I don't know how I feel about you taking my 14-year-old daughter's virginity, old man. I don't know about that. That's not. So that was a thing. The founding swingers were now like aging or deceased, and the younger members were more interested in exclusive traditional marriages.
Because they didn't want to have to fuck the 80-year-olds,
well,
I'm guessing.
Well, I also assume as a way to rebel against their parents.
Yeah.
I mean, like, if you have parents that are fucking religious tightwads that refuse to let you have sex, you become Ariel from Footloose and want to fuck everybody with your red cowboy boots. But if the parents of Footloose had been swingers, Ariel would have been, like, actually monogamy, waiting till marriage. Fuck you guys. It's the circle of life.
Truly.
All of these culminated in a campaign by one Professor John Mears of Hamilton College. So Mears was your typical preacher of the time. He hated Mormons, he hated liquor, and he hated this free love bullshit. Not fun at parties.
No.
So he called for protests against the Oneida community for all of the moral reasons you would expect for protests against the swinging cult in the countryside. At the same time, John Noyes was informed that there was a warrant for his arrest on the charges of statutory rape.
Ah.
Which,
how old is he at this point?
Old.
Okay.
And he was fucking teenagers. He was fucking teenagers.
They weren't like, wrong.
They weren't wrong. So he did what anyone accused of such crimes in the state of New York do, which is escape to Canada. It's right there.
It's right, yeah.
And it's also like 1870. Like, you just go to fucking Canada.
There's no border.
Right.
You just keep going until you see fur trappers.
Someone's vaguely speaking French. From what I assume is a cozy cabin in Niagara Falls, Ontario, Noyes wrote to his followers that maybe complex marriage should be abandoned. Maybe. Guys, you know, we did this for a while, and maybe we need to give it up.
Wasn't it your main thing?
It was the main thing, but without him, the community just abandoned it. They were like, yeah, all right, we're done. Not surprisingly, many community members who were already cohabitating with made their partnerships official. And over 70 members entered interdictional marriages the following year.
Wow.
So the community formally dissolved and converted to a joint stock company on January 1st, 1881.
Okay.
Well, they had all those businesses.
Yeah.
They had all the businesses. So all the businesses became like a business. But they stopped doing the fucking everybody thing.
Hmm.
Although Noy has never returned to the U.S., he remained a powerful influence over many of his followers. He died in Niagara Falls, Ontario on April 13th, 1886. His body was returned to Oneida and buried in the Oneida Community Cemetery with many of his followers. During the early 20th century, the community's joint stock company, Oneida Community Limited, became Oneida Limited and narrowed its focus to silverware, becoming the largest producer of flatware in the world for much of the 20th century.
Mm.
So many histories and first-person accounts of the Oneida community have been published since the commune dissolved. I've already mentioned one, which is the Oneida From Free Love Utopia to the Well-Set Table by Ellen Wayland Smith. That was one of the citations. Another interesting account is found in Assassination Vacation by Sarah Vowell, discussing the community general and the membership of Charles J. Gateau, who was a member for more than 5 years.
Oh, man. Okay, yeah, because I was like, this sounds familiar, and I have definitely read Assassination Vacation.
So you know who Charles J. Gateau is?
Oh, yeah.
The man who assassinated President James A. Garfield.
Yep.
A president who admittedly hadn't done anything wrong. He'd been there for like 3 days.
And hated Mondays.
And loved lasagna. So today, the Oneida Community Mansion House is a nonprofit educational organization chartered by the state of New York. It welcomes visitors throughout the year. It has guided tours and programs and exhibits about the Oneida community and related themes of the 19th and 20th centuries. The mansion house also houses residential apartments, overnight guest rooms, and meeting spaces, which is where I assume every swingers convention is held in perpetuity.
Oh, yeah.
And that's the Oneida community.
That's, I mean, I had an inkling, but boy howdy.
I mean, again, as cults go,
it's not the worst cult. I'm not going.
Well, it doesn't exist anymore.
For now.
I mean, again, it was more just like the thought of, again, like starting in like the 1850s, like a bunch of people in the 1850s were like, hey, guys, I think I'm poly. Are you poly?
Yeah.
I think we're all poly.
I mean, honestly, it's just every Ren Faire somehow.
It's every theater program in colleges across the United States. Oh, my God. Oh. Everyone just be fucking, honestly.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. Well, do you have a self-care plan for us?
Yeah. All right. So, I figured we could do some self-care tips. Regarding sex, I don't know. It's been on my mind.
For the last 90 minutes.
A while. Schedule a wellness visit. Make sure whenever you are participating in sexual activity that you go to the doctor and get yourself checked out. You know, you want to make sure your pelvis is looking good. Get tested for HIV and other STIs. When you're sexually active, it's very important to just give yourself routine checkups and to make sure everything is healthy physically as well as spiritually. Schedule sexual intimacy. The idea of scheduling sexual intimacy doesn't seem very fun, but now as a person with a child, like, you kind of have to, or you never have sex ever again.
Yeah.
It may be seen as lacking spontaneity, but actually it's really important to, like, make that part of your routine. Go in front of a committee of your favorite community members and just say, hey, guys, I'm thinking Tuesday at 9.
I absolve you of this Tuesday at 9.
And finally, don't fuck teenagers. If you're not a teenager, just don't fuck teenagers. Yeah. Let teenagers fuck each other.
Honestly, if you are a teenager, consider not fucking teenagers.
It's never good.
No.
As somebody who was a teenager that fucked other teenagers, it's not fun.
It's not great.
It's not great. Like, Making out's fun. Just stick to that, honestly.
Yeah.
Usually people don't fuck that one up nearly as bad.
Oof.
Well, anyway, that's going to be all for this week, folks.
If you like what you're hearing, you should check us out on thisfnguypod.com. We are working on it, I promise. Or on Twitter at thisfnguypod. We don't check it. We don't post to it. Do the thing that we actually do and just check us out on Facebook because I'm an old, old woman. You can also donate to our Patreon, which is also thisfnguypod.
I'll check on the status of that. I promise.
We have so many episodes that we're planning on recording for that. It's gonna be lit. It is not lit yet, but it's gonna be lit.
It will be. As always, I'm Ren Martinez.
And I'm Ginger Golub.
Here's a bonus self-care tip, which was clearly written for me personally, Ren Martinez, by one Ginger Golub. Make sure you're using special characters and your password is way more secure. Fuck you, baby.
And don't be this fucking guy.
Peace. This fucking guy.